Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. We're going to start the podcast in just a few seconds, but first I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks so much, and here's the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We're just making a movie. It's not life and death. It's not worth life and death.
In the wake of tragedy that took the life of a young assistant camerawoman, veteran producer Marty Katz talks about staying safe on sets, and cinematographer Haskell Wexler on his long quest to improve safety. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, why some Middle Eastern countries say they'll ban Darren Aronofsky's Noah. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, if it appears if there are deep waters for the movie business, it would be the waters of religion. And now when it works, it works. We saw that with Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. And when it doesn't work, it's a disaster. We saw that when Martin Scorsese made The Last Temptation of Christ. And now we have Paramount with Darren Aronofsky's Noah and already taking a lot of fire from various religious groups.
Yeah, there's basically three different things that are going on. One is the religious right is upset that it is not kind of truthful to the Bible, although, you know, that's a much longer debate about what biblical truth is. And then there's the backlash now from the Middle East, which I suspect was not the sweet spot for the film. And some countries are not going to show it. And then there's the whole feud between Paramount and filmmaker Darren Aronofsky. So the charge against Hollywood is that it never deals with religion, that it ignores faith, it ignores the Bible, it ignores Christian stories. And yet when a studio like Paramount and New Regency take on Noah, it's almost you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah, it does seem like they were waiting for an opportunity, some elements of the Christian community in this country, to jump on this, you know, Hollywood ruining the story of Noah. And obviously the story of Noah is rather slender in terms of exactly what is spelled out. And Darren Aronofsky has filled a lot of that in with his imagination. Paramount has tweaked its marketing campaign to make it clear, and this is in response to input, they say, from Christian groups, to make it clear that this is not a literal, but more of an interpretation, Darren Aronofsky's interpretation of the material. And at the same time, as you said, the Middle East, we have Qatar, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates saying they will not release it. And Egypt is a maybe. And, you know, I just feel like, wow, when you do this kind of thing, you just have to be really careful.
Yeah, the movie doesn't come out until March 28th, but it's also very much testing the adage, there's no such thing as bad publicity, because I think this is ultimately polarizing audiences before they've even seen the film. And you said input from Christian organizations. I think the real threat was a boycott, and I think that's the reason Paramount said they were going to put a disclaimer on the marketing material surrounding the film.
Absolutely. Now, in the world of television, we have a big deal, a deal between Dish Network and ABC, the owner of ABC, more properly, the Walt Disney Company. They have entered a dispute over the use of AdHopper, which is this, it's called AutoHop. They have made a deal for Dish to carry certain material from ABC, and Dish has agreed that it will no longer use this ad-skipping technology, AutoHop, on this ABC content. And this has been a big threat from the point of view of broadcasters. Obviously, the broadcasting model depends on advertising, and this feature allowed people to just push a button at the beginning and skip over all the ads in a show, which is very tempting to a lot of people, but now they will not be allowed to do that until 3 days after the shows air. So if they want to miss the ads, they will have to wait 3 days to see this programming.
Yeah, those 3 days are incredibly important to the network because those 3 days include Nielsen ratings. After the 3 days, they are dropped. So it's important that in those 3 days, they get a full measurement of that audience. Now, 2 years ago when AutoHop came out, CBS, Fox, NBC, ABC all sued Dish. As part of this deal, Disney, which owns ABC, has dropped its lawsuit. And it's also going to work with Dish to create some sort of video online streaming service. So I think the key question now is whether or not other companies follow in Disney's footsteps.
And it seems likely that they will. And in a sort of a similar challenge to the whole broadcast model, we have upcoming arguments at the Supreme Court over Aereo. And this is a service that allows you to receive broadcast television programming in your house. You can cut the cord. You basically rent a very, very small antenna that is kept in a warehouse somewhere in New York or elsewhere, and that allows you to record and watch broadcast shows.
Yeah, over the internet. I mean, you don't have to have your rabbit ears on top of your TV. It's been a very divisive case among courts. You know, some courts have ruled on behalf of the broadcasters. Some courts have ruled on behalf of Aereo. Now it's going to the Supreme Court, and the United States government has filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court taking the side of the broadcasters, but being very careful to say, well, some storage devices like Dropbox or Amazon storage doesn't violate copyright. It's incredibly complicated copyright law. And ironically, Cablevision, who is one of the plaintiffs trying to shut Aereo down, they have to essentially repudiate a famous case in copyright law called Cablevision, where Cablevision won and was able to have remote DVRs for its cable subscribers. So it's a very complicated case. Now the United States government has taken the side of the broadcasters. Supreme Court's going to hear argument over it. Not a big business so far for Barry Diller's company, but this could have huge ramifications for it and for other companies that want to emulate it.
Yes, and the point again being that if you are getting these programs without a cable connection, the broadcasters were not going to pick up fees from the cable companies that they're paid to carry this programming, and therefore they lose money. And that is why they do not want you to get your programming by way of Aereo. So moving on from that to something that happened, you know, last week. So it's a bit ago, but I'm sort of hung up on it, I admit. And this is the famous selfie during the Oscars. And, you know, I have to give Ellen credit. Ellen DeGeneres, she tried to create a little bit more of a fun, spontaneous environment during the telecast. As we've said before, it was rated very highly. However, this seemingly fun, spontaneous selfie that was taken with a bunch of stars on the screen, this much retweeted selfie, was not spontaneous because it was paid for by Samsung, on which the selfie was taken.
Yeah, Samsung bought two kinds of advertising on the Oscars. By some estimates, about $20 million of actual commercial time. And then, you know, several million dollars, it appears, for product placement, for Ellen DeGeneres to use a Samsung phone to take the picture, or I guess it turned out Bradley Cooper to take the picture. Very good product placement. I don't know how many people were actually looking at the back of the phone to see that it was Samsung. I suspect the pizza company that got a little bit better screen time for delivering pizza into the Dolby Theater. But a very clever, I think they would call it integrated marketing, where it's impossible to skip that ad. You might skip all the other ads in the Oscars, but you couldn't skip the Samsung product placement that Ellen DeGeneres had.
I have to agree, although I have to say I was like, I unloved it once I found out that it was this designed moment because I felt manipulated, and I don't know how many others did, but I suspect I'm not alone. You know, I would say these kinds of ads, as you say, this kind of product placement, they can be very clever, but sometimes maybe they're a little too clever.
Yeah, on behalf of Coca-Cola, I think you've got it right.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can keep up with us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney's, is at Darby KCRW. Perhaps you noticed at the end of the In Memoriam tribute at the Oscars, the photograph of assistant camerawoman Sarah Jones. More than 55,000 people signed a pledge urging that she be included in the montage after the 27-year-old was killed last month during the filming of the Greg Allman biopic, Midnight Rider. The tragedy occurred as a 20-person crew was filming a dream sequence on a train track spanning a river in Wayne County, Georgia, when a train going almost 60 miles an hour came barreling across the narrow bridge. There was little time to flee. Jones, possibly struck by debris, was killed, and several others were injured. An investigation is ongoing. This is potentially a criminal matter, and it appears that the production company may have been shooting on the track without a permit. It appears that no representative from the railroad was present, and standard safety protocols were not in place. We reached out to filmmaker Randall Miller, to his unclaimed Freight Productions, and to distributor Open Road, but none has commented. The production has been suspended indefinitely. The Midnight Rider crash brought back memories of the 1982 helicopter accident that killed Vic Morrow and two child actors while shooting the Twilight Zone movie. It has renewed calls in the industry for greater focus on safety. To understand what should happen on sets, we turn to producer Marty Katz. He started in the business with the King of the Bee movie, Roger Corman, and has had a four-decade career as a producer and production manager. He also spent 10 years as vice president for motion picture and television production at the Walt Disney Studios. When we reached him in his office, Katz said members of the Directors Guild are routinely trained in safety protocols, so he believes individuals on the Midnight Rider set should have known what to do.
If you're operating on a live train track, the first protocol is that you know what the time that you can be on that track safely is, and making sure that there's a person from the railroad company there to monitor any train progress that's going down those tracks, and making sure that you, the production company, are well out of harm's way when a train is approaching with enough time to do it. So I can't imagine people setting up equipment on a live railroad track and not having a representative from the railroad there to monitor things.
But you also have, like, maybe a medic, maybe an ambulance,
First of all, the call sheet for that day. The call sheet is the document we issue the night before that says to everybody where you're going to go tomorrow and what you're going to do tomorrow. And so on that call sheet, standard protocol is to list the emergency numbers of the local police and fire and paramedics, to list the closest emergency room, to list the ambulance numbers. All of that stuff would be there, and that's number one. Number two, every production, when it shoots, either first unit or second unit, has to have a medic with them. And we have medics that work on all productions of all sizes. And sometimes people take shortcuts because they're doing what they call a splinter day or a pre-shoot day. And sometimes if they take those shortcuts and they don't have medical help there, things can go wrong. And in this case, apparently it did.
I assume you've never even been on a set where those things were not in place because you wouldn't have allowed it?
No, I would never. In fact, even in my Roger Corman days, when we did low budget movies at $200,000 or less, we would make sure that if we were doing something risky, we were outside, we definitely had a medic or a nurse.
I mean, do you hear about, for example, within the industry now, we hear a lot about, you know, the emphasis on cost and how expensive everything is and keeping the price down. And we even have this whole model of low-budget movies, you know, that some of the studios are trying micro-budget movies. Do you suppose that the safety procedures are becoming variable because of that?
I don't think so. I think that, particularly in the case of a studio, no matter what the budget, it's cheaper to pay for a medic and to follow safety protocols than to wind up at the end of the day embroiled in a lawsuit for millions of dollars because of negligence. And I think that, you know, the insurers that insure these movies, I assume that every legitimate production has necessary production insurance, liability insurance, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to rent locations because they couldn't present certificates of liability. So I assume that every production has insurers, and every insurer would absolutely demand that you follow the safety protocols.
And these protocols don't vary from state to state, or do they?
Well, no. There's no laxity in safety. I mean, safety regulations, a lot of them are just good common sense. We're trained by the Directors Guild of America as the assistant directors and production managers to follow certain guidelines and regulations, and they don't vary. You don't put people in harm's way. There's a certain limited number of people you can put on a camera car. There's a certain protocol for helicopter shots and explosions and checklists for how you do those things. And those don't vary no matter where you're filming. Even if you're filming in Romania, it doesn't matter. That's not what governs the safety. You're supposed to govern. The production is supposed to govern the safety guidelines.
Do you attend, like, a class when you become a member of the Guild?
I'm looking here right now at a notice I have from the Directors Guild saying I have to go take a safety pass training session program before July, a four-hour program, as a refresher course. Otherwise, I'm not allowed to work in California.
So this is a requirement. Is it a legal requirement from the state of California?
Yeah, it says the Directors Guild of Producer Training Program, along with the Contract Services Administration, and it's in conjunction with the California Safety, CalOSHA. So,
right.
Yes.
The Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So periodically you must refresh your skills in this respect, even if you're a veteran.
Right. Every once in a while you need to get a refresher course because things change and technology changes. And you know, now that we've moved away from film to digital, a lot of other things are changing and batteries explode and things, you know, just things you have to be aware of.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with veteran producer Marty Katz about the issue of safety on film sets. We asked Katz what crew members should do if they're on a shoot and being told to do something that feels unsafe, as apparently was the case for some on Midnight Rider. For more on that, go to kcrw.org/thebusiness.
Your first call is to the first assistant director saying, I don't think I can do that. I don't think that's safe. How do you assure my safety? And the first assistant director will either be able to answer that question or defer to the unit production manager or to the line producer. And then they should be able to answer that question. And then if they can't, they'll defer to the producer or the director and say, listen, they don't want to do this because they don't feel it's safe. And we agree. And ultimately, the line producer, somebody has to use common sense and say, they're right, and we don't want a lawsuit, and we shouldn't do that.
But let's say I'm on a smaller film, and it's like a smaller company, and I truly believe that I am being put at risk. Is there a union rep that I can call? Or
absolutely. You can call your union. You call the studio safety department. You call. You drop a dime on whoever you have to do it. You certainly have the right not to do it, and they can't fire you for doing something that they can't prove to you is safe.
And in the real world, Doug, is somebody not taking their job in their hands if they do rat them out, so to speak?
You know what? It's very simple. Your life and your safety or taking that risk. I would certainly defer to the latter. I'd take the risk. I'd call my union rep. I'd not do something that they couldn't prove to me was safe.
Where does the buck stop? Who is the ultimate word? Is it the director?
Well, in feature films, the director runs creatively runs the day's work in terms of what he wants to accomplish and what the shots are. But it is ultimately the producer and his line producer who have to be where the buck stops, because they're the people responsible to the investors or the studio and to the insurance company and to the bond company. They're the ones who have been hired to manage the production. And they have to wear blinders when it comes to the integrity of the shot versus the safety of the crew. Their blinders only show them the safety of the crew.
When you look at this very sad story, and I think a lot of people in the industry are very, very upset about what seems to have gone on here. I mean, you probably talk to a lot of people, and I'm sure that's your same sense, right?
Yes.
So what is the takeaway? I mean, is there a failure to regulate? Are the unions not active enough?
I think the takeaway is this. Every few years, as you know, a event happens, whether it be Vic Morrow and the child actor dying by the helicopter blades on Twilight Zone, whether it be several crew members who died after working 17-hour days and then driving home because the company didn't take precautions and get them home instead, whether it be this incident. Every once in a while when these things happen, the takeaway is that people are more aware of the risks. I'm just hoping that people stay aware, because after a few months and this dies down, and unless someone goes to jail for this, you know, people get complacent again. But the best production people won't allow it to go away. They'll always keep, you know, safety first, because it's just a movie. We're just making a movie. It's not life and death. It's not worth life and death.
Marty Katz has a nearly 40-year history in the film and TV business, which includes a decade as head of movie and television production for the Walt Disney Studio. Thank you so much.
And my pleasure.
Next, Oscar-winning cinematographer Haskell Wexler says the Midnight Rider tragedy is a symptom of lax safety standards in the film business. That's coming up after a short break on The Business from KCRW.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. In the wake of the crash that killed assistant camerawoman Sarah Jones during the filming of Midnight Rider, Academy Award-winning cinematographer Haskell Wexler released an open letter that he addressed to fellow workers. Wexler alleged that Jones and those injured, quote, were not victims of an accident, but of criminal negligence, close quote. As we said earlier, an investigation continues, and neither the filmmaker nor the production company has responded to requests for comment. Now 92 years old, Wexler, whose films include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, has spent nearly 20 years campaigning for greater safety on sets. Specifically, he's battled against long work hours that lead to dangerous fatigue. His fight was inspired by the 1997 death of Brent Hirschman, a 35-year-old cameraman killed when he fell asleep at the wheel after working a 19-hour day on the film Pleasantville. Wexler believes that chronic sleep deprivation creates immediate physical danger, takes a heavy toll on long-term health, and can destroy families. He made that argument in his 2006 documentary, Who Needs Sleep? Wexler doesn't see the tragedy on the Midnight Rider shoot as a result of sleep deprivation, but he believes that accident does reveal an all-too-common indifference to safety. What wasn't in place in your mind on this shoot?
What was not in place is just common sense. Never mind rules or regulations, because on films, the never mind for rules and regulations are pretty strong, particularly, we'll say, in the state of Georgia, who gets incentives to get films there. They're not going to do anything that might impede the actions of producers. And I think as the further examination of this thing happens, you'll see the culpability spreads pretty wide.
In terms of who was on set or beyond?
It has to do with, I think, of what we as film workers that go into our job knowing that what the employer tells us to do, we have to do. And once you have that, you will take what would be common sense and put it in your suitcase and say, you know, I can do it. But that doesn't mean that the employer, whoever it is not culpable. But that's why I use those words, that so-called accident was not an accident because it was definitely preventable.
It appears that they were stealing a shot in this case.
Yes, they. At some point, they. It's a good feeling, you know. I mean, I've been around it. I've done it. I've been complicit in it, you know. I'm thinking, no, we'll get this and be it over with and be okay, you know.
Yeah, we're kind of cool. We're kind of guerrilla style. I mean, do you look back at something that you did and think, I really was out of my mind to do that?
Yes, I look back at a lot of things. But then,
can you give me an example?
I also protect myself and see, but damn, Haskell, you got a terrific shot, you know. And of course, the director of photography is sort of the captain of the ship. And a strong director of photography can say, this is not safe for my boys.
Right.
And occasionally girls.
Right.
And most of the time, producers have to listen to them, but directors of photography can't say that too much because they're not going to be hired.
So looking at the Sarah Jones case, it's easy to blame the bosses because they seem to have been very irresponsible.
I think with the fact that there is media publicity, it's going to be clear that the bosses are at fault. And I have to say that we as workers who have dealt with all kinds of unsafe, unhealthy conditions on the set find ourselves complicit, or at least reluctantly complicit, for a number of reasons. Because we want to work. We want the overtime. We delude ourselves into think we're being artists or whatever. We're making great films. And if we don't do it, they won't hire us. So with all those factors there, we're going to be quiet.
So let's talk about the hours. That's been your cause. You know, this accident, of course, is not necessarily at all related to long hours, as something quite different in this case, you know, at the train tracks. But the hours has been a hazard. How long have you been advocating on the issue of hours?
It began when a first assistant cameraman, Brent Hirschman, died driving home after a 19-hour day.
On the movie Pleasantville.
And if you look at the records, the total Hollywood community came out and said that this ongoing condition that we have of working these extreme hours threatens the safety and the lives of people on the set. Because when you're sleep deprived, you're the same as drunk.
I mean, it's been such a struggle since Brent Hirschman died. And I don't know, do you feel that you have made progress? I don't know what the average hours were then, but has there been an improvement?
No, there has not been an improvement. Since Brent Hirschman died, 14, 16 hours is on the call sheet. It was not as widespread then.
So it's actually gotten worse.
Yes.
Why is it that way? I mean, I saw in your film, the late Dick Zanuck says, oftentimes, to get a budget approved, they lowball the time that they need to shoot, and then they have to rush.
Yeah, that was Richard Zanuck, who was a producer, a really good producer. And what it is some invisible force, because they're given a budget, they're given a time, and to do that, the director has to work these extreme hours. They don't want to. The actors don't want to. Even the producer doesn't want to. But there's an unwritten god, and it's the god of the bottom line.
You spend a lot of time in your film trying to get the IA, the union that represents a lot of below-the-line mm-hmm. crew members, to respond to your wish that this would be addressed. And yet they just don't seem to do it. Why is that?
After Brent Hirschman's death, the thing that bothered the big companies was the IA, the Directors Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, all the guilds and all the representatives of people who make the film saying excessive hours has got to go. But then they said to all those groups, look, we're in charge. Forget that. You don't mess with our managerial flexibility. And those people who were set to protect people backed off.
Do you feel that it is up to the cast and crew to effect change? Because how do you visualize change coming about?
The organization 12 on and 12 off on March 28th. Is letting know all the production managers and producers, they're going to say to them, do not schedule more than 12 hours for work on that Friday, March 28th. After 12 hours, nobody's going to work. And this we're doing as a little statement about trying to straighten out safety and how it relates to our life beyond movie making.
That was Oscar-winning cinematographer Haskell Wexler. You can find a link to his documentary, Who Needs Sleep, on our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Will Bentley. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.